Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is an old friend. Her name is Mary Jordan, and she has an outstanding history and career in journalism all over the world. We'll be talking with her about her experiences in Washington, in Tokyo, Mexico City, London, and the rest of the world. Fascinating life, fascinating person. With respect, Mary Jordan. Mary, how are you this morning?
Excellent. Excellent. Good. Greetings from Washington.
Yeah, well, I was going to say how terrible I sympathize with you because of the cold weather. You're probably all the way down to the 50s down there.
Oh, come on. 25 this morning. 25. I'm a Cleveland girl at heart, so I know what it's like to be on the lakes.
All right. Let's have disclosure. You and I met each other back in the Irish Embassy around the early 1990s at a party there, as I recall. And we've been friends off and on, contacting each other over the years since then. But I followed your career around the world, and it's a wild career, but it started in Cleveland, of all places.
Well, it's interesting you say about the Irish Embassy. So my parents, my dad was a farmer in County Mayo, Ireland, and my mom grew up on the west coast near Achill in Ireland, and they moved to Cleveland in 1957, not that long ago. My brother was born over there, and the rest of the six of us were born in Cleveland. And so we were, you know, of all places, had they gone to New York or Hawaii, I wouldn't be a Cleveland gal, but I am.
All right, well, you know, my mother's family are from County Cavan. We hide behind the name Smetanka, but there's some Irish in there, too. Well, all right, what got you started? What did you do in Cleveland?
I went to St. Joseph Academy in high school, and, you know, my parents, you know, my dad was a pipe fitter, the immigrant family, it was all about education, and really, there were two options. You were supposed to be a lawyer or a doctor. Everyone else in my family pretty much is a lawyer or a doctor. But I went to Georgetown. I studied poetry. I got a scholarship to study poetry at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. And I didn't want anyone ever to have me as their doctor. I thought I was doing the world a favor. Like to write, so I kept getting. We all paid for our own school, and I kept getting scholarships pushing me that way. And now I've written in over 40 countries, and I was based for 14 years abroad, and returned to the United States about 5 years ago.
Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl, was a guest on my show some time ago, and I asked her, you know, she's a very nice person, and you're a very nice person, Mary. But she writes some really about some really horrible things and people. And I was interviewing, and I said, so, Gillian, how can a nice person like you write these horrible stories? And she said, you know, John, when I was a little girl, I used to just love to tell stories to myself to scare myself. I used to love to scare myself. And so I'm just playing out what I did before. So I say to you, nice person, Mary Jordan, you're all over the world, you're from Cleveland, how did you get, what's the bug that got you into journalism?
I think what fires me up is injustice, and I thought that I would run an NGO and help the poor. I worked, you know, in high school in homeless shelters. I just couldn't believe there were battered women's shelters, and I did the hands-on thing, and then I realized that, you know, maybe I should use your talent in a different way. And so I started writing about poverty and injustice. and I've done that all over the world, and I think it's just that it gets me upset. I'm mad as hell when it's not people's fault, and something rotten happens to them. And, you know, I think that the gift of each of our lives is that you're on earth to make it easier for other people somehow, and so that's what you want to try to do, shed some light on something that's wrong and see if you can fix it.
Well, how about the rest of your brothers and sisters? You say that some did not, the rest of them did not escape from the family template of being lawyers or doctors. So do they do kind of this sort of work also?
Well, I have a sister who's a doctor in California. She had gone to Stanford, stayed out there, and she works on Ebola. She's worked around the world in Africa and helping people get better. And then I've had two, a brother and a sister, who were prosecutors and lawyers. And so I think everyone in their own way is trying to make, you know, again, I think the challenge is take the gifts you've given and give back.
Yeah, that's the key for everybody. There was just a host on one of our shows talking about at the end of your life, how do you assess what's of value? And he's a philosopher and professor of history, and it was an interesting question because, you know, the old story is at the end of your life and you're dying, do you wish that you could attend one more meeting?
you know, and as many people have said, you know, there's no hearse that's pulling you all full of things and fancy houses and
that's
all
right.
The accumulation. So, you know, I think I was lucky. I've met such interesting people all over the world, from, you know, the Queen of England to interviewing the Paul McCartney, sumo wrestlers in Japan, the princess in Japan, really, you know, fascinating people. But of all the people in all the countries, it was a Catholic nun in Mexico who worked with the poor, who probably had the most profound effect on me, and she used to talk about this a lot. We called her Madre Antonia, Mother Antonia. Ended up writing a book about her called The Prison Angel. But she grew up wealthy and gorgeous in Beverly Hills. You know, big house, 13 bathrooms. And twice divorced, unhappy. And she went into Tijuana. She drove down from fancy California into Tijuana and just saw the utter destitution there. And nowhere was it more stark than in a prison, because not that long ago, it's changed in the last decade, but really, even into the 1990s, in the Mexican prison in Tijuana, if you had money, you were a drug lord, you can have a jacuzzi. I kid you not. You can slip some money to the guard and have him go get you a lobster. But if you're the poor guy that was caught stealing a loaf of bread, you have nothing. You actually have to work in the prison to get some money to get some food, because you pay rent and you for your own food in the prison. So Mother Antonia saw this, went into the prison, stayed overnight in the prison, ended up basically living voluntarily in the prison to help the poor. She always had peanut butter and sandwiches, and she was fixing people's teeth and getting them adjusted on the outside. And, you know, she would say, she would ask you a question, you know, at the end of her life, and she just died. There was a big obituary in the New York Times this year about her. And she would just say, you know, it has been the greatest satisfaction and joy of my life to have, just to have the chance to have impact on others for the good.
Now, you know, let's talk about her for just a minute, because this flows right into what I started to talk about, which is, you say that she was A, rich, B, physically gorgeous, C, had loads of interesting experiences, married twice, divorced twice. What, how, compact that. How old was she? No, seriously, now.
It's really an astonishing story. So at 50, two failed marriages, she really just, she was in a midlife crisis, I guess you would say. So she leaves Beverly Hills, drives down, she thinks she's on a day trip, and she just kind of gets hooked on Mexico. I lived in Mexico for 5 years. I could see how it happens. Kept going daily down there, then returning across the border, and bit by bit started staying there. And because she was twice divorced, the Catholic nuns, there was no kind of warm embrace to become a nun having been divorced twice. So, but the prison guards saw this very blue, gorgeous, blue-eyed, blonde woman coming into the prison, giving out food and bringing bandages, and they were worried about her safety. And they said, you know, if you could just put a habit on, they would respect you and leave you alone and not, you know, be hollering about how good-looking you are. So she did that. She sewed a fake habit and began wearing this non-uniform and a veil to kind of hide her gorgeous blonde hair. And this kept this year after year. I mean, it was so innocent in the beginning, and then she started doing this, and then in a while, she just kind of thought of it as a uniform. Well, the bishop of Tijuana found out there was a fake nun, or a woman, parading as a fake nun in the prison in Tijuana, called her up. They made a meeting. She said, you've got to come and see my ministry, because now it had grown to kind of a vocation, and she had some helpers. He came and saw what she was doing, talked to other people, and said, you are doing better work than all of us, and go ahead, and why don't we put you on the path to become an actual authentic nun. And in time, Pope John Paul came to visit her. She met Mother Teresa, and she started this fantastic order called the Servants of the 11th Hour. And it's for women who are too old, you know, supposedly too old to be taken in by any other Catholic order of nuns. You know, they're 60, 70 years old. They're librarians, they're nurses, they're all these people. They still have a lot to give, and they have joined her order called the Servants of the 11th Hour.
An amazing story. Mary's an amazing person. This is a book that you wrote. What's the name of the book?
The Prison Angel.
Is that still in print?
Yes, it is. You can get it on Amazon, and I think there's going to be a movie. There's been lots of discussions about whether that will be a movie. She certainly is an amazing story. And again, she just died. Her real original name was Mary Clark, and in Tijuana, when I'd walk the streets in Tijuana with her until fairly recently, even a few years ago, she was, everyone knew her. She had touched, I mean, she had gotten plastic surgeons in La Jolla, California to come down and take tattoos off gang members' faces, so that they could, because they had tattooed their faces, and that kind of marked them for life.
Yeah.
And so she had gotten these fancy surgeons to come down and change people's lives one at a time, and she did hundreds of tattoo removal, thousands of people. She got their teeth fixed. She used to say, you know, if someone can smile, it makes them feel better, and all these people who had literally no teeth, I mean, it's utter poverty, she fixed. And she her thing was, you know, everyone can make a sandwich. Everyone can do something for somebody else.
How old was she when she died?
She was 87.
So we're talking 37 years, right, essentially, of this kind of calling.
And 36 of those, she lived in a pretty notorious, violent prison with just cold water. I mean, I can't tell you the conditions. It was pretty shocking.
She lived in the prison, or she just came to visit?
No, she lived, the beginning she would come and go, but she ended up, there were so many riots and so many problems at night that she realized that her presence was a calming presence in the prison, so she ended up having her own bunk and stayed inside.
How do we develop people like that? I mean, you know, just think about it. There are so many problems here and around the world, and you wonder who is going to help solve them. And then people like this, Mother Teresa, you know, in a smaller scale, I'm going to give you humility here, yourself, other people that I've known, and they do something on the micro world that never gets the attention. Somebody doesn't write a book about them. But how do we get them?
Well, I'm certainly not putting myself in that category, but I have been lucky as a journalist who's written about remarkable people, many of them, like you said, not necessarily known, but certainly remarkable. I think one key is that they all have perseverance. They have a high tolerance for discomfort. And, you know, it's offset by enormous satisfaction. But even great musicians, the power of the mind that enables them to be disciplined and put the hours and the time in. It's really perseverance and knowing, you know, that if you just keep at it, there's going to be payoff.
You talked about interviewing Paul McCartney, and we're going to take a break right now, but I want to come back and talk about some of the other people that you have interviewed, and also your own work in getting a Pulitzer Prize in 2003. Right now, we're talking to Mary Jordan, who is a worker. It's going to be complicated later on, but has been a foreign correspondent and a writer for the Washington Post for many years, an old friend of mine. And this is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Mary Jordan. I guess we could start off by calling her an investigative journalist, but now she's taking up some different areas of writing endeavors. But we'll get into some of that later. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. Mary, you talked about, and I know that you have interviewed many, many fascinating people. But let's take the one you talked about, music, and you talked, well, there's a fairly well-known fellow you talked about, Paul McCartney. What did you find interesting about him?
Well, just as disarmingly charming and kind, and, you know, despite the adoring crowds, people fainting, you know, I mean, he's had a whole lifetime of people just screaming to be near him.
I have never had that, Mary.
I mean, really.
My dogs don't listen to me.
You didn't have the Beatlemania.
I guess not.
Crazed. People ripping their clothes off. John. He is just a kind man. My husband and I were, Kevin Sullivan and I, a rare husband and wife team that do a lot of interviews together. We were the London bureau chiefs, and we went over, and he kept saying, "Hey, just sit here, watch me conduct this." And he had written something called The Requiem for his late wife, Linda, and he just talked. I mean, he's just a genuinely lovely guy. Still working, still singing. I mean, good on him.
Yeah, good on him is right. How about the Queen of England? Now, what was that one all about?
that was rare. She doesn't really have people over to her house that often. But at least, you know, Americans like me.
Yeah.
But she had, this was just good timing on our part. We were living there, and she was coming to the United States for a visit. And on the eve of the visit, this invite comes to our house in London saying, on the eve of her trip to the United States, she's having a small reception for Americans living in London. And somehow we get on the list, and we go over to Buckingham Palace, and everything is orchestrated there. You know, you're to come at 2:15, not 2:30. You know, you're coming in a certain door. And when we arrived, there were maybe 100 people that were assembled, and it was a hodgepodge. Don Johnson from Miami Vice was in a theater production in London, so he was there. There were kids that were rowing, who were Rhodes Scholars, that were rowing in some tournament there. It was really an interesting group of people, and her handlers came over and said, "In a few minutes, the Queen will be coming to talk to you. You will stand in a U-shape. She will stay in the middle." And we did exactly what they said. You know, we're in her extremely grand room in Buckingham Palace. And she was charming. I mean, she saw the rowers, and she asked them to turn their hands over because she knew about the blisters you get from the oars.
Yeah.
There was a soccer player. I mean, she had something to say to everyone. She was quite charming.
All right. Now, let's get truth here. Did you curtsy?
Oh, no. I'm Irish. I did tell her she had a lovely house.
Oh, yeah. All right. All right, Mary, let's backtrack a little bit. You got your first job in Ireland, I understand. How did that happen?
I was studying Irish poetry at Trinity College in Dublin, and I needed some extra money. And I met the editor of the Irish Press then, a fabulous guy named Tim Pat Coogan. And he said, you know, if you want to write, give me a column. You can call it the American's View, you know, call it the American's View and write something, you know, and send it to me. And if it's any good, I'll publish it. So I wrote a couple articles. I mean, it didn't. And those articles ended up getting me the job at the Washington Post, where I started when I was 23.
We had a woman who wrote a book, Lynn Olson, wrote what I consider the best historical pieces about the run-up to the Second World War that I have read. She wrote many other books, but her job started off as, I can't remember whether it was a, she was for AP, and she, I think, was like a social writer for AP, and she couldn't really bear that. But they called her up one day and said, hey, how about you becoming our international correspondent, our Russian correspondent in Moscow? And she was 23, spoke no Russian, had no experience with Russian.
Wow.
And she said, of course, absolutely, and did 5 years there back in the bad days. The old
guys
were.
That's a life changer. You do have to every so often just get out of your comfort zone and just go do it.
That's right. Okay, so you got to work for the Washington Post. How did that start off?
Well, I was quite terrified because I was quite young. I got an internship for 3 months, and Ben Bradley, who just died, he was running the paper in all his glory. And 12 people, there were lots of applicants, 12 were picked, and then he said, okay, at the end of summer, one of you will be left standing, so go to it.
God almighty.
And we had a terrific class that year, and they picked another person who was an amazing writer, and I was kind of number two, and they said, my boss said, well, everyone likes you, it's just that we only have one job, so why don't you go out to the suburbs, don't come downtown, go to the suburban Washington Post Bureau, and then hopefully a job will open up, and they won't know that you're still here. So I went out there, and I kept writing, and one day I was writing this funny story, a sad and odd and funny story about this woman who thought she brought the wrong baby home from the hospital, and she had walked into the suburban bureau, and I just listened to her. I could tell the angst, and I verified everything she said. She had gone and got microfiche and found every kid born in the 24-hour period at this hospital, tracked where they were now, and the twist of the story is that she was 70 years old, and this baby that she thought she brought home was 50. But she really didn't think it was her. The kid was hers. She hired an FBI guy because on the birth certificate there was a baby's footprint.
Uh-huh.
At that time, they put a little baby's footprint on the birth certificate, and I called this guy up that she said she hired, and he said, yes, this woman said, and I told her she's right. I got her son's footprint, and the thing on the birth certificate just doesn't match. So we wrote this whole long saga about the ends this woman had gone to see if her son was her son, and went on the front page of the Post. And that morning, 8 or 9 doctors called Ben Bradley and said, there's this new technology. It's about DNA testing. And it's gonna, and we'll offer, you know, we could test, we can find out, and, you know, because this was obviously a long time ago, more than 30 years ago. And Ben called me in and said, there's nothing like daily journalism. My phone is ringing off the hook with doctors from all over the place who want to find that lady and help her. And I just thought I had the best job on earth. And he said to me, how long you been working here? And he goes, I said, well, I'm not really sure I'm working here. I'm waiting for a job. And he hired me right there.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And Ben Bradley was a larger-than-life figure. And he figured in another part of your life, which is we're going to get to a little bit later, which is the Watergate issue. But let me take on some of your other things. You went with your husband out to Tokyo. How did you get out there, and what was that like?
Well, the biggest story in the world at the time was the war in the Balkans, and they had asked us if we would cover that, and we had been married a week. And they said, oh, this is perfect, you know, two young people, two writers. I had already been at the Post for 7 years, so, and Kevin came in as a hot shot. And so Kevin looked at me and said, we should not go cover war because they're going to put one of us on one side and one on the other. And we'll never see each other. And so I would credit Kevin with actually being wiser. I had been at the Post so long, and when they came to me and said, you can have the biggest story in the world, it was harder for me to say no. And sure enough, about 6 months later, they said, well, how about Tokyo? That's a better place. And so it was indeed a better place for starting our family. We ended up having a baby over there and had a wonderful time.
I noticed in your life story that you take the time to learn the language of the place you're going. You went out to Stanford to study Japanese?
We studied Japanese at Georgetown University.
Oh, okay.
And then we went to Stanford to study Spanish.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Before we left for Mexico. So each time we had a full year off to study the language and then kept it up while we were there. That said, Japanese was a lot harder than Spanish.
Yeah. What did you learn about the Japanese culture and society that most interested you?
I think, there is this fantastic appreciation for appearance, the appearance of your food. It's just, you know, that you should set the table. It's part of the whole experience of eating is to have a beautiful plate.
Mm-hmm.
And a beautifully set table. And, you know, especially when I came back to America, it was so shocking, this whole fast food, shove it in your mouth, don't eat mm-hmm. while you're standing up. I remember being jolted alive from the care and aesthetic value given, you know, with a high purpose of just, you know, life is short and enjoy it. That's why they love the cherry blossom so much. And, you know, it's just with how they see life in many ways. It's just short and beautiful, and you have to enjoy it right now. And I think on the downside, it was, again, really tough to be a woman, a Japanese woman. Again, it's changed. I was there 20 years ago. But Jane Fonda was then married to Ted Turner, and Walter Mondale was the ambassador. And Walter Mondale's wife, Joan, and Jane Fonda were invited, along with their husbands. They had invited a bunch of the heads of business leaders over to the embassy, American embassy. And not a single woman accompanied the Japanese men. And not only that, but when they went through the receiving line, nobody would look the women, Jane Fonda or Joan Mondale, in the eye or even talk to them.
Mm.
And so Joan Mondale called me up the next day and said, you've got to write about this and tell them that I'm upset, that we asked their wives to come. They should look at me. You know, I mean, it really was hard mm-hmm. for women. It is getting better. There's more women who are becoming entrepreneurs. But what a shame. Half the brain power in the country is not used as well as it could be.
Mm-hmm. In your time in Japan, how long were you there?
4 years.
What did you focus on in terms of your writing? Because Japan, you've mentioned two aspects of Japan, which are very interesting and very people-oriented, but the economic condition in Japan has gone through a fascinating series of ups and downs, which are just huge.
Well, we were there for the crash. The Asian financial crisis happened when we were there. And so before that day, when the price of real estate fell 70%. So before that, when we first arrived, you know, it was outrageous. People were literally sprinkling gold on food. You know, they had these opulent dinners where the famous, the naked women sushi, they would get some beautiful woman and with practically no clothes on and put as a centerpiece, she would lie down the center of the table and they would eat sushi off of her. There were...
That's an interesting appetizer.
You couldn't think of... People said if you put a $10,000 bill down on the ground in the heart of Tokyo, you couldn't pay for the rent underneath it. It was just this dealing with what do you do when all of a sudden you're think that you had a lot of money and you don't. And it happened right around the region, Korea, Thailand, the baht fell, the Korean won fell. It was quite a scramble there. I mean, in Korea, the stores, things were 90%. Suddenly, if you had a dollar, you could buy, the value of what you could buy just went up about 90% in Korea overnight.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, a lot of people, there were Korean men who were too, had lost their jobs overnight and would still get up, get dressed, put a briefcase, and just go to the park and sit in the park all day. They were just so ashamed and didn't know how to deal with not having a job and not being able to take care of their family.
Well, we're going to take another break right now, and we're going to come back and perhaps in a different country, different part of the world. We're going to talk about Mexico City and your time there. This is John Smetanka. We're talking with Mary Jordan, investigative reporter and journalist and author and world traveler and a hell of a fun person. This will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Mary Jordan, who is works with the Washington Post, but is also an author in her own right, along with her husband, Kevin Sullivan, and the winner of the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for her writing about, or their writing about, the prison system, the criminal justice system in Mexico. Mary, tell us about how you got involved in that.
Well, it's sad to say, but it is still probably the story in Mexico. I love Mexico, I miss Mexico, I love the culture, I think everything, I love the food, I love the people, love the warmth, and they deserve a better system. It is disaster. It is outright corrupt. I would have to teach my kids, if you see a policeman coming near you, you run. I mean, even if you'd stop at a stoplight and you saw a cop coming behind you, you would actually go through it. I mean, it just makes me so sad, and it makes a lot of my Mexican friends sad. So we started from there. It mattered, really, when you had a system where you don't know who to trust, where the prison system, if you're a drug lord, they were constantly being busted out. They would just pay the money, and they would be able to wheel out laundry carts. And perhaps one of the greatest men I ever met was the man who was running this organized crime unit, trying to take down the drug cartels. And at any given moment, he had 20 bodyguards. He was ultimately killed when they blew up his plane. But what a guy who was really trying to fight the good fight. The deputy attorney general was a friend, and when we'd go running in the park, he had to have 10 bodyguards with him. Because once you took a step for justice, and if somebody killed somebody, you put them behind bars, they would go after you. So no one wanted to be a policeman, so the only people that were taking some of the jobs then were people that were in bed with the criminals.
I remember being in Mexico City with a friend of mine who was the rector of a colegio overlooking Mexico City, and we had gone to the seminary together, and he went on to become a priest, and I went on to do my little life. And I remember him describing his impressions of how day-to-day law enforcement affected even his students and himself. And he said exactly the same thing that you've just said. He said he said if you are stopped by a police officer, they're going to get money. They want money, and that's it. And you just have to be extremely careful. The Anglo-Germanic way of looking at law enforcement does not exist in Mexico
City. No, it doesn't. Actually, I actually did make a illegal U-turn in Mexico, and the cops stopped me, and it was, know, and I thought, oh, geez, you know. And all he wanted was $15.
Yeah.
So, and it was actually my fault, but it is a whole system. But there's that little petty stuff, but then there's the really big stuff. And again, I visit Mexico. I'm not saying it's not a place. The kidnappings, really, they don't target Americans, but there is, if they can just fix the justice system, just do that, what an amazing achievement and what a wonderful thing it would be.
I remember when I was in Main Justice in Washington, back when, about the time that you and I first met. I remember a delegation. I used to meet these delegations from foreign countries, and they would we would talk about matters of mutual interest in law enforcement. I remember I was standing in the hall and talking to a group of Mexican prosecutors, attorney generals, folks, and others, and. I was taking them on this tour, and I at one point they stopped me and said, "Can you not share with us? We are trying to stop drugs coming into your country, but every day we're being told we're not worthy of getting information, the information that you have, and we feel like second-class citizens," and they used some other phrase. But the point was that the look on this one woman's face was so pathetic. Don't you trust us? Can't you trust us? Our lives are in jeopardy every day.
See, that's the million-dollar problem, because certainly you can trust. There are very good people, and I certainly met them and idolized them for what they were doing against harm for themselves. But in their ranks, there are a lot of corruption right to the top, and so it's very hard to know. I mean, who do you bring in on raids when you're trying to take down somebody?
That's right.
And there's a lot of anger on the other side of the border about the appetite for drugs that has destroyed Mexico. It's the American appetite for drugs that has caused so much violence in their country. And, you know, in Sinaloa, a beautiful part of northern Mexico, the Americans came in and planted poppy to make morphine in World War II for the soldiers. And, you know, that poppy had a legacy now. And, you know, the Americans are not, you know, they're part of the equation here.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
And their cooperation has to happen, but you can see why it hasn't.
Well, you know, on a sidelight, it infuriates me when we are so high and mighty in some of our op-ed pieces and some of our people who want to get FaceTime on television to preach about how, in Afghanistan it's all poppies and it's heroin and this is all. And some, I'm not saying those folks, but so many Americans are making the market.
Oh, yeah. No,
and it is just infuriating to hear people, some of them the fanciest and richest people, doing the most... Well, anyway, I'm getting on my soapbox.
And quite a lot of people in Mexican prisons, which are not great places, let me tell you, because I spent a lot of time in them, are, like, there'd be a mom. I met this person with different names she had. You know, this was just this too common story. She was a mother, had little kids. Someone said, if you just carry this package from this town to that town, heading north, we will give you the equivalent of $100, and to her that could be a month or 2 months' salary. So all she had to do was carry the small packet from one city heading north to another city, and then take the bus back. She gets picked up, and she's in jail sometimes for 10 years for that. And literally, it would be the equivalent in pesos, be like 1,000 pesos or $100 US. That's it. Years of her life gone. And so it is the collateral damage of somebody who wants to have cocaine or heroin in the States. You know, they don't think what's happening when you walk back that trail of drugs.
That's right. That's right. Well, you also, wrote a series of articles on this Mexican justice system and the Mexican prison system, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2003, you and your husband. And you almost won another one, as I recall, later on.
In fact, I think our best work, but it's not about prizes, is we spent a year in 2009 looking at discrimination around the world against women. And it is not just in poor countries, not just in, this, in Muslim countries, but pretty much every country. In Pakistan, it was pretty serious, and stark. I got out Peshawar. I had to wear the hijab, and I looked around. As far as I could see, there were hundreds of men on the street, not a single woman, because their place was in the house. And I was up there to try to see, to get into a jail where men who were sick of their wives, all they had to say was, "She cheated on me." Just saying that put her in jail. And then in other parts of Pakistan, that if, you know, if, let's say that I have a brother and my parents die, automatically all land goes to the male. So women don't have the right to get land inherited. There's just laws. I mean, it's just black and white. Land goes to men. Now, what that means in a place where land is everything is just stunning. It just delegates these women to poverty. But like I said, it's not just in these countries. In Germany, the discrepancy in the workplace is huge. And, you know, we have problems in our own country about that and equal wages. So it was a really fascinating look about the state of women right around the world.
Well, you know, you also talked in some of your writings about, both in the Mexican area, but also in your writings about England and Germany. You talked about, and now Pakistan, the concept of rape is not one which just is treated as a serious offense in some places.
Well, I think the thing that would surprise most people is that in England, you know, the mother of all democracies, the basis of our justice system, is that rape, you cannot get a conviction. It is like a 99% chance that if there's a rape, it will not be convicted. There's a thought that if a woman has a glass of beer, darn, that was her fault. You know, I mean, it's not taken seriously. Very hard to prosecute. Again, especially if there's any liquor, it's like, oh, well, it was her fault. You know, it was kind of the old thing about, oh, well, she was wearing a short skirt. Just surprising, just people thinking that it's not that big a deal. You know what? It's not that big a deal. It's just rape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is a story which can be repeated in many other areas, and I, as a former prosecutor, I know two of the areas that are shocking, were shocking to me, is back in the day when I first started, it was very difficult if you tried a drunk driving case to get a conviction, because, hey, you know, everybody does it. I could just see and hear the arguments made by some attorneys that, to the jury, oh, ladies and gentlemen, there but for the grace of God go us when we come home from a party. And bingo, gone, done. And the other area was child sexual abuse. I remember a jury coming out of a deliberation which they acquitted a father of having had sex with one of his daughters, and in parentheses, he apparently had sex with another one. But at any rate, this foreman came out and said to someone who was associated with our office, well, we just didn't believe that any father would do that to his daughter.
Oh, wow.
And that was an attitude that was prevalent. It's now changing. And it's now, that's what I want to lead to. That was an attitude in both of those areas that parallels what you're talking about with the issue of rape. And in each of the cases that I know, and you're talking about rape as a parallel issue, it starts with culture, the culture of the people. And by that, I mean it can be on the micro level, just a community. Oh, this is how we think. And it's hard to change it until there are groups of people, a movement like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Students Against Drunk Driving, and so on, that will mobilize a community to change their cultural attitudes.
Absolutely. No, that you're, I mean, it is a reflection. The justice system is a reflection of somebody, of a society, and certainly juries and judges, too. Sometimes they lag behind, and I think you're right to have movements kind of leading the way on this. And there has been a lot of headway made, and, you know, sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back, but it is going in the right direction.
Mary, you've now moved from foreign correspondent to working in more of your media, the internet, as I recall, and digital kind of work. Quickly, can you talk about what the Post is doing to meet the demands of the modern world, i.e., the internet? Because, you know, we read about how the Post is shedding their reporters, and you know, newspapers all over are doing that because they can't figure out how to deal with the
media. Well, it's a great time to be at the Washington Post because Jeff Bezos, the brilliant guy that owns Amazon and figured out how to make it very easy for everyone to buy things online, is now the owner. And we have, every month, we hit another record-breaking. It's now about 50 million different people go to WashingtonPost.com, and he has his sites way higher than that. It's, people around the globe now, and he said very clever things about if you buy certain local papers, let's say a Pittsburgh paper, you go and you pay for the Pittsburgh paper and you get the Washington Post digital subscription for free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great because it helps prop up the local papers, which are key to communities, and also gets more airtime for the foreign correspondents and White House reporters that the Post has, which are very expensive to maintain and might be hard for the Cincinnati paper or some Missouri papers. So it's actually a great time to be at the Post, and they are hiring, and it's kind of a hot place now because the digital eyeballs on our website are just going through the roof.
And that's what you're doing.
And I'm now, in 2 weeks, starting to write about American politics. I think I'll be like the senior correspondent on the campaign trail for the 2016 presidential campaign, just kind of writing bigger pieces and profiles. And I thought I might as well try that since I've done 10 other things around the world. I've written about Japanese politics and British politics. Might as well start this one. And I think, we have another book coming out in April. And so between the book and the campaign trail, it's going to be a big year for me.
And I'm going to take a break now, but when we come back, I want to talk about that book and about what you're writing about and how that folds into the work that you've been doing elsewhere in your career. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on the air today with Mary Jordan, a foreign correspondent, investigative reporter, author, world traveler, and a hell of a nice person to boot. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Mary Jordan, who works for the Washington Post and has done for most of her career. Before that, she did a little work on Irish poets in Dublin, which is close to my heart. But we have been talking about her career as it, where it started from, what her motivations are, what really gets her going in the morning. And Mary, there's a story which broke around the country and around the world, but happened in your home community of Cleveland. You have some involvement in that. Tell me about it.
So there was this quite big case that's now almost 2 years. It was called the Cleveland kidnapping case, and a guy named Ariel Castro who was a school bus driver, had kept three women. He kidnapped three women and held them, chained them in his house and held them as slaves. And it happened not that far from where I grew up, in the west side of Cleveland. And I knew several of the people, the lawyers and people in the court and the FBI that were helping these girls. My brother had been a prosecutor, and he had passed away way too early of cancer, but he was well known there, and my mom was still there. And so people were asking me for media help, because literally there was the BBC and Australian radio, and people were wanting movies, and everybody wanted to talk to the girls, and they just, I kind of started informally advising them about how to stay low and if they didn't want their picture taken. And over time, they just asked me if I would help them write their book. And then so my husband and I actually spent a year with them. And the new book is coming out in April called Hope, A Memoir of Survival. And it's two of the three women. We actually tried to get all three of the women, but one of them wanted to do her own thing and get it out right away. And she's already been out. But our two, including one of them that had a baby while captive by this guy, Ariel Castro, those two have never spoken since they busted out of that house 2 years ago. And there'll be kind of a big splash on TV when it comes out in April.
Well, this folds into what we've been talking about, and that is in a number of different areas. One, of course, is the role of women in various cultures, that something like this imprisonment of women or children is in some places sort of a macho thing. It's a, you know, hey, this is my right, you know, hey. But on the other hand, it speaks to the role of women in cultures of different kinds and with crazy sorts of people. But it also talks about your interest in bringing these sorts of things to light. Is this sort of a culmination of the work you've done before?
Well, I hope not. I hope I get to do another 20, 30 years culminating.
I didn't mean to write your obituary, Mary. This is not.
But I do feel privileged to have done this, because I remember when they were asking to help, I was kind of ticked about stupid things. You know, there was somebody at work that was annoying me. You know, I had a slight but annoying medical problem, and I was thinking everybody else has it so great. Well, you know what? No one has it so great. Everyone's got their issues, and there are some people, some extraordinary people like these two women, who have had everything taken from them. I mean, literally locked in the dark, fed like dogs for years, and they can come out of it. You know, you can see the resilience and the will to live and the will to enjoy things and not feel sorry for yourself. It was a life changer for me. I mean, I'm not allowed to complain about anything anymore.
Well, that, you know, I've in my career, I have seen a number of individuals, and since I can speak from that kind of experience, that I've seen horrible, horrible things happen to young people that you think that it's impossible for anything to come good out of their lives. I mean, how can they possibly, if they have seen abuse, if they've had 13 or so women in their father's life, and they in and out, and babies produced all over in poverty, and it just goes on and on and on. I have seen some people come out of that with remarkable contributions, and to themselves, yes, careers, but also to the people around them. And they come out fighting. I know this one individual fights for the rights of the poor and the rights of the criminally charged power. And but his background, holy mother, it's terrible that he had to come up through nothing. So I think when you were talking about the Mary Clark from the rich side of life in California going into the worst poverty in Mexico, I was thinking about this particular individual. Remarkable, remarkable things about the human spirit.
Well said, John. You know, I mean, you were saying before, you really are, it's wonderful that you're doing this program. You know, you're a very kind and thoughtful person, and you yourself have had such an interesting career that it's great that you take to the airwaves and don't do the screaming thing that has everyone else so annoyed. You know, we're tired of that. The polarizing debate, and it is nice to that you take the time to talk to people about things like remarkable contributions that we can all do in life. So.
Well, you know, it's fascinating, Mary. I met your brother. I'm not sure which of your brothers. I hope that was not the brother who just died early at the dinner and at the Irish Embassy. But was it by any chance?
No, it was. It was my younger brother, Tom.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I met your brother, and I too have a brother who is probably the reason I'm doing this show for the past 9 years. And that was I was drive around the country campaigning or handling cases and whatnot, and as I would drive around and listen to radio, we were raised on radio, and I remember getting to the point I could not stand shout radio. I could not stand it, and so I was complaining, I was ranting to my brother 9 years ago, and he was tired of my rants, and he said, fine, you don't like it, do your own show.
That's great.
And I saw it.
I
did.
Yeah, that's
but
great.
It's. I want to go for one final point to talk about tying things together in your life and what you see going on for the future. And that's, you're a journalist. A journalist under the American, Anglo-American, I suppose, mystique is you're supposed to be objective and you're supposed to report objective facts and let the conclusions from that people want to draw from those be drawn, whereas in many other parts of the world, journalism is considered, first of all, a crusade. But you're sort of bending both. We know now what it is that really turns you on when it comes to attention, the role of women and the poor. The sick, the imprisoned. How do you balance when you are doing a story, the objectivity that we traditionally expect of our journalists with opinion? Where does that balance come?
Well, so my passionate interests draw me to the selection of what I write about. And that's that how it plays. I think that, of course, you want to be fair. I think the best way is, are you fair? I teach journalism, and I had every kid in the class be interviewed by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I had them come in and then have them read the article about themselves and see how it feels. You always put yourself in the other people's shoes. Is this fair? And so my passion chooses the topics I pick, and fairness guides the work, and I think that's just how I see it.
Well, I look forward, Mary Jordan, to reading your articles about the 2016 campaign, and I want to make sure that you're fair to everybody, including Republicans and all those other people that I'm. Unfortunately, the poster is always told, oh, you know, they're all terrible. At any rate, seriously, I wish you...
Fair to everyone is fair.
That's right. Mary Jordan, it's been a pleasure. Please give my regards to Kevin, who I've never met, but he made an excellent choice in marrying you, and you guys have produced many interesting projects. Keep it up for many years. I know you want to do it for another 20 or 30 or 40 more years, and keep your passion, okay?
Thank you. A delight to talk to you. And
likewise.
Thank you for anyone out there who took the time to listen.
All right. The name of our program is With Respect. We are on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And remember our mantra, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.